Welcome to this fourth episode in Series 2 of Nightmares of a Doctor. In this series, we explore the extremes of human existence. Some of the themes in these stories will be challenging, and listener discretion is advised. If you are suffering from a mental health condition and find yourself in need of advice, try to speak to a loved one or someone you trust. If you are still unsure, seek advice from your registered GP, who can refer you on to one of the many available support services. If you or someone you know are dealing with a mental health emergency, you should urgently contact your local crisis support group. Talking costs nothing, but it could be worth everything. About 12,000 years ago, in what was known as the Stone Age or Neolithic period, there would have been an individual suffering from delusions or hallucinations due to a condition that we now understand as psychosis. But his friends would have made their own interpretations of what was driving this person to behave in such an unexpected manner. Perhaps some of them resolved to drive him away, dismissing him as a madman and a disruptor to their already fragile lives. But some must have seen him as a problem to be solved. Perhaps driven by curiosity, or maybe even by love, they would have held a hope that his illness could be cured. These Stone Age people made a decision to try and fix their stricken friend. They went out to select a suitable stone and brought it to the one with the necessary skill and strength. It would have taken several others to hold the man down, while the person with the stone would have raised it above their head. Forget the delicacy of modern surgery. That sharpened stone became a club, hammering down with imprecise blows. They took aim for the temporalis bone in the side of the skull, because that would have presented the larger and easier target. It would take several strikes to stun the man unconscious. Perhaps the first caused a fracture, like a crack across a window, but it would take many further blows to penetrate the scalp, to get down to the skull and chip away a segment, exposing the brain. Those Stone Age surgeons would have admired the dural skin that encases the brain, and beneath it those glistening, lobulating gyral folds that make up the structure that houses the mind. With their patient now sedentary, perhaps even biddable, they may have concluded that their efforts were successful, explaining the response as the effective release of evil spirits from the hole that they hammered in the side of the skull. But in the treatment of psychosis, their procedure, which we now refer to as trepanning, did nothing for their patient. Of course, no documented report of their pioneering efforts was ever recorded, but we know that this story in its essence to be true because of the extensive archaeological evidence uncovered from the Neolithic period. This shows the remains of preserved human skeletons, some of which contain these similarly sited holes in the side of the skull. In these cases, the characteristic callus-inducing reaction that all healthy bone produces indicates that these individuals survived their operations and were even nursed back to health. In the history of neurosurgery or brain surgery, very little progress was made until many thousands of years later. Nowadays, this procedure is now called a craniotomy and is effectively used to relieve pressure within the skull. This may be due to bleeding or a buildup of cerebrospinal fluid in a condition called hydrocephalus. Within the finite dimensions of the skull, an increase in its contents leads to an increase in pressure. And if that pressure is not relieved, the brain will be squeezed and distorted until the tissue dies. In the history of neurosurgery, or indeed of medicine, many pioneers experimented with their patients in attempts to advance their field. Empowered by the trust society placed in their skills, their only limitation were the ethics that bound them. One such experimentalist was Dr. Walter Freeman. Born on the 14th of November, 1895, in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Freeman grew up in the long shadow cast by the successes of the surgeons in his family. He seemed destined for medicine and attended Yale University, graduating in 1916, before studying neurology at the University of Pennsylvania Medical School. In 1924, Freeman relocated to Washington, D.C., where he began practicing as the first neurologist in the city. It was during this time that he observed firsthand the terrible pain and distress of the patients indeterminably institutionalized for their mental health conditions. These formative experiences would prove vital in establishing the motivations that centered Freeman's later work. He gained his PhD in neuropathology before securing a position at George Washington University as head of his department. Freeman was renowned not only for his academic productivity, but also his evident enthusiasm for education. He had a habit of wearing a wide-brimmed hat, round-rimmed glasses, and a long goatee, while he also carried a cane and wore an engraved gold ring on a chain about his neck. The gold ring had once belonged to an unfortunate patient who had presented to Freeman with the ring wrapped around his penis. After surgically removing the ring, Freeman insisted the ring remain forever close to his heart. In time, Freeman had developed a reputation as something of a showman, and with his distinctive appearance and engaging personality, he began to acquire an almost celebrity status. As his career progressed, he held simultaneous faculty positions at Georgetown University as well as George Washington University. He frequently hosted educational weekend postmortems for his students, who were drawn by his theatrical demonstrations and the prospect of audience participation. Meanwhile, across the Atlantic, major experimental advances in the field of psychosurgery were being made. People suffering with severe schizophrenia had very few options and were often peripheralized to the fringes of society, often into dangerous and disreputable asylums. Antonio Moniz was a Portuguese neurologist who offered a solution to their crippling afflictions. After observing significant changes in character and personality amongst soldiers who had suffered traumatic injuries to the frontal lobes of their brain, Moniz believed he could replicate the effect surgically. Freeman saw the revolutionary potential of this surgery to treat or even cure the many institutionalized patients who were suffering from psychosis. By cutting through the tissue between the frontal lobe and the thalamus, it was thought that this would sever through the neurological channels believed to promote excessive emotion. But Freeman had a problem. As a neurologist, he was considered an expert in diseases of the brain, but he had received no formal surgical training and so was not licensed to conduct operations. But he was able to recruit James Watts to join him in his practice at George Washington University, and together they resolved to master Moniz's technique. In September 1936, Freeman and Watts found a patient who consented to their neurosurgical experimentation. Alice Hammett had a diagnosis of agitated depression, and these two persuasive and charismatic doctors offered her a solution. Despite initially agreeing to the procedure, the night before the operation, Alice withdrew her consent. On the day of the operation, she continued to resist, maintaining her resistance right up to the point that they administered general anesthesia and rendered her unconscious. They began their operation. Freeman and Watts acted as co-surgeons. Watts provided his surgical expertise, while Freeman dictated the pace and progression of the procedure by applying his extensive understanding of neuroanatomy. They shaved Alice's head, cleaned the scalp, and drilled through both sides of the skull, creating what are known as burr holes, each one flanking the frontal lobes of the brain. They then passed a cylindrical metal device known as a leucotome through each of the holes, deep into the white matter tracts of the brain. These are the nerves that allow communication between the prefrontal cortex and the thalamus. Freeman was able to rotate the leucotome from outside of the patient's skull. This rotated the sharpened edges within, allowing him to core out these white matter tracts. According to Freeman's documentation, when Alice awoke post-operatively, she stated that she was happy. 6 days later, she began to experience language difficulties, disorientation, and agitation. But Freeman was unperturbed and unequivocally declared the operation a success. Freeman's lobotomy was born. In the next 6 years, Freeman and Watts had performed approximately 200 lobotomies, and Freeman published his first major case series. He described about one-third of his operations as successful, in that the patient was able to lead what he described as a productive life. Another third were able to return to their homes, but unable to support themselves. The final third, Freeman regarded as failures. Often his patients had to be retaught how to eat and how to use the bathroom. Relapses were common, and about 15% died directly as a result of Freeman's intervention. Despite drawing criticism from the medical community, Freeman continued to gain support from the popular press. During this time, the would-be president, John F. Kennedy, had just graduated from Harvard University before signing up for the US Navy. The Kennedys were a powerful family, who even before John Kennedy's presidency had strong political connections. But John's sister Rosemary was considered something of a liability to the family's ambitions. It is said that during her birth, the obstetrician was running late, and the attending nurse ordered Rosemary's mother to keep her legs closed to delay the imminent birth. This terrible advice caused a harmful lack of oxygen to Rosemary's brain. While Rosemary survived her traumatic birth, growing up it was evident that she suffered from a mild disruption to her normal development. Despite struggling academically, many signs point to her having a largely happy and fulfilling life as a child, and she played an active part in her well-known family. At the age of 15, she was sent for specialist tuition at the Sacred Heart Convent. But she did not enjoy her time there, and she wrote to her father, Joseph Kennedy, saying, "Darling Daddy, I hate to disappoint you in any way. Come to see me very soon. I get very lonesome every day." When Joseph became the US ambassador to Britain, Rosemary joined her father in London, and she thrived at an English convent school. She developed an interest in social welfare and expressed an ambition to train as a kindergarten teacher. Lawrence Lerner, an acclaimed journalist and author, is recognized as being a leading authority on the Kennedy family. He described Rosemary as being, at the time, a picturesque young woman, a snow princess with flushed cheeks, gleaming smile, and a sweetly ingratiating manner to almost everyone she met. However, other reports describe Rosemary as being irritable and difficult and subject to mood swings. In 1940, at the age of 22, she returned with her father back to the US, where she was sent to another convent school in Washington, D.C. Her warm, friendly manner and natural beauty inevitably drew her plenty of admirers. But the nuns at her convent became increasingly concerned when she was observed to break the convent's rules and sneak out at night. Some suspected that she may be socializing with men, which, regardless of whether she was or wasn't, seems quite a natural thing for a young girl to do. But from this emerged a hysterical fear that Rosemary would contract a sexually transmitted disease, or worse, become pregnant when she wasn't yet married. Her relationship with her father became frustrated and uncommunicative, and he soon became paranoid that her unpredictable behavior could potentially jeopardize the family's political ambitions. So Joseph Kennedy consulted with Dr. Freeman. After hearing of the options that could be offered to his daughter, Joseph immediately authorized a lobotomy for his daughter. In November 1941, Freeman and Watts performed the procedure. Both were reputed for meticulously detailing their surgical procedures. Rosemary's was documented as follows. We went through the top of her head. I think Rosemary was awake. She had a mild tranquilizer. I made a surgical incision in the brain through the skull. It was near the front. It was on both sides. We just made a small incision, no more than an inch. The instrument Dr. Watts used looked like a butter knife. He swung it up and down to cut the brain tissue. As Dr. Watts cut, Dr. Freeman asked Rosemary some questions. For example, he asked her to recite the Lord's Prayer, or sing God Bless America, or count backwards. We made an estimate on how far to cut, based on how she responded. It was only when Rosemary started to become totally incoherent that they stopped cutting through her brain. Joseph did not inform his wife of their daughter's lobotomy until after the procedure. It was immediately apparent that the procedure was unsuccessful. Rosemary's mental capacity had diminished to that of a 2-year-old. She was left incontinent and unable to walk or to speak intelligibly. Her parents told anyone who asked that Rosemary had gone to teach at a school for handicapped students out in the Midwest. But in reality, Rosemary was institutionalized at Craig House, a private psychiatric hospital just outside of New York City. Her father never visited her, and the truth of her lobotomy was kept hidden from the family for over 20 years. While her older brother John was campaigning for presidential re-election in 1958, the Kennedy family explained her absence by claiming she was a recluse. After John was elected president, they revealed she was institutionalized for what they called her mental retardation. When her father Joseph suffered a stroke in 1961 that left him unable to speak, Rosemary's siblings would come to learn the truth. Her lobotomy would not become public knowledge until 1987. For Freeman, Rosemary was just another patient amongst the many he lobotomized. His professional ambitions were more motivated than ever. Not long after treating Rosemary, Freeman began a tour of the many state hospitals, spreading his views and performing lobotomies. His eccentric charisma enabled him to cultivate positive relationships with writers from many of the prominent national newspapers. The Saturday Evening Post commented on his work in the following way. A world that once seemed the abode of misery, cruelty, and hate is now radiant with sunshine and kindness. The wealth of generous media attention catapulted Freeman's lobotomy into the mainstream. What the public didn't know is that there was no reliable scientific evidence supporting these dazzling and profligate claims. In July 1943, a report landed on the desk of Frank Hines, a veterans hospital chief. It was a memo recommending Freeman's lobotomies for veterans with incurable mental illness. The memo stated, "This operation may be done in suitable cases under local anesthesia, and it does not demand a high degree of surgical skill." Dr. Hines approved the order, and in the next 10 or so years, the US government would lobotomize approximately 2,000 American veterans. This order ensured that Freeman had a limitless supply of patients. While his innovative approach saw his professional reputation soar, Freeman's life at home was beginning to unravel. In 1946, Freeman took his family on a camping holiday in the Yosemite National Park. While hiking along the spectacular mountain ridges, his 11-year-old son leant down to fill his flask at the top of a roaring waterfall. Freeman watched helplessly as his son lost his footing and was swept over the edge to plummet to his death. Freeman's wife, Marjorie, was already an alcoholic, but with the loss of her son, she sunk into depression. While he must have suffered greatly, it seemed Freeman's professional ambitions were only enhanced. he was single-handedly driving forward the burgeoning field of psychosurgery, and the death of his son had narrowed his focus. But despite his successes, his ambitions demanded something even better. After learning of the exciting neurosurgical interventions of Italian psychiatrist Amaro Fiamberti, Freeman needed no persuasion to re-enter the fray. Up to this point, Freeman and Watts had accessed the brain through burr holes drilled either side of the skull. Not only did this require a neurosurgeon to assist him, but it also needed an anaesthetist to ensure that the patient stayed alive while sedated or unconscious. But Freeman recognized that the delicate orbital bones behind the eyes offered a more elegant route of entry into the brain. It was while rummaging around his own kitchen that Freeman stumbled upon a device he saw had potential. The long, slender steel that made up his wife's ice pick seemed in Freeman's eyes ideal for the task. He practiced upon grapefruits before graduating to cadavers, but it didn't take long before Freeman felt ready to experiment upon people. Sally Ellen Ionesco was a 29-year-old housewife and mother who suffered from manic depression and suicidal ideation. On the 17th of January 1946, she entered Freeman's Washington, D.C. office. Under Freeman's direction, she lay down upon the couch positioned before his desk. She lay flat on her back and tried to relax as he applied conductive material either side of her head. Freeman then placed a gum shield in her mouth before connecting two electrodes to the areas of skin overlying her temples. He turned to his portable electroshock machine and did something that nowadays would be regarded as unthinkable. While the patient was still awake, he turned the machine on. Sally convulsed until Freeman turned it off. She suffered a brief seizure, then lay on the couch, stunned. Freeman watched with satisfaction. He could now proceed. He'd moved on from his wife's ice pick and had specially commissioned the creation of a longer and stronger piece of steel. He called it the Orbitoclast. Standing to Sally's right, he opened her right eye and slipped the pointed steel under her eyelid. Freeman manipulated his device around the soft eyeball until its point connected with the bone at its back. He pushed it more firmly, gaining purchase on the bone, before reaching around for his mallet. The orbitoclast stood erect, pointing vertically into the air, while Freeman used one hand to steady its base just next to Sally's eye. Then his hand glided up to the top of the device. He held it in place, adjusting its angle, before bringing down the mallet heavily upon its top. It took several forceful strikes before Sally's orbital bone gave way, gratifyingly crackling as Freeman lanced through. Having penetrated the skull, Freeman now had access to Sally's unprotected brain. With his orbitoclast in position, he swept the device round in lateral movements, backwards and forwards in a rapid swirling motion, feeling the give as he sliced through the brain tissue. Once satisfied, Freeman withdrew the orbitoclast out of Sally's right eye socket, before moving over to the other side and doing the same to her left. Once he was finished, he sent her home in a taxi, on her own 2 feet, with nothing more to show than her 2 black eyes. Freeman named his technique the transorbital lobotomy. Freeman's partner, Watts, opposed this new approach. He took issue with Freeman's disregard for sterility, which needlessly risked infection, and disapproved of complex neurosurgical interventions being performed outside of a well-controlled operating theatre. It was this last objection that Freeman loved. Not only did the procedures which he performed in his own office relieve him from needing a neurosurgeon and an anaesthetist, but his independence from the operating theatres allowed him to operate despite not having a surgical license. Watt saw clearly that Freeman's movement in this direction marginalized his own involvement. Watts's disapproval peaked during the treatment of Freeman's 10th transorbital lobotomy patient. By Freeman's account, Watts had observed the procedure and voiced his disapproval. By Watts's account, he had already specifically requested that Freeman not perform this procedure in their shared outpatient offices. But despite this request, Watts entered an office to see Freeman standing over an unconscious patient with a steely orbitoclast lodged deep within his orbit. Freeman returned Watts's horror with his warmest greeting, graciously offering that Watts assist with the procedure so he could take a photograph. Watts did not assist. Soon Freeman was working with a new neurosurgical partner, and his partnership with Watts was effectively finished. Watts was not alone in his condemnation of Freeman. In 1948, Freeman was invited to demonstrate the transorbital lobotomy at a veterans hospital in Tuskegee, Alabama. After speaking with Freeman and learning of what would indicate a transorbital lobotomy, the chief of psychiatric education openly mocked Freeman's liberal application, remarking that a pain in the neck might as well qualify by Freeman's rash standards. A Veterans Army neurosurgeon also evidently shared Watts's view on Freeman's office operation, saying that non-surgeons like Freeman would perform lobotomies at veterans hospitals over my dead body. But this would not stop Walter Freeman. In the summer of 1952, he conducted a lobotomy tour of West Virginia, where in a 12-day period, his reckless enthusiasm drove him to perform an astonishing 225 lobotomies. An instinctive showman, Freeman loved to perform and encouraged the media to watch and take photos even during his lobotomies. He also knew how to make a spectacle and enjoyed the thrill of shocking his audience. On one occasion, he used two of his orbitoclasts simultaneously, driving each into both of his patient's eye sockets, wielding both in each hand to slice through the nerves on both sides of the brain. During one unfortunate case, he paused the procedure to pose for a photo. As the cameras flashed, Freeman's grip slipped and the device dipped forward, severing vital structures. The patient began to die and the procedure was abandoned. But in front of his crowd, Freeman demonstrated his shameless indifference as he dismissed the death caused by his own hand before eagerly turning to his next waiting patient. Freeman's popularity was beginning to wane. Foreboding depictions of mental institutions, lobotomized patients, and corrupt mental health officials was beginning to influence public disenchantment with Freeman and his methods. In 1960, Howard Dully was 11 years old. He was an introverted boy who liked riding his bicycle and playing chess. On occasion, he was inclined to fight with his brother, disobey his parents, and steal sweets from the kitchen. He earned money from a weekly paper round and was saving for a record player so he could listen to his favorite music. By all accounts, he was an average child. Perhaps a little unruly, but nothing that wasn't unusual for a boy of his age. Howard had not had an easy life. His mother died of cancer when he was just 5 years old, and his father remarried to someone he described as cold and demanding. His father and stepmother subjected Howard to regular beatings and punished him by forcing him to eat his meals alone. Increasingly convinced that there was something wrong with her stepson, Howard's stepmother consulted with a number of psychiatrists who collectively determined that Howard was not suffering from any active mental illness. Despite this, somehow a referral to Walter Freeman was made. Howard's habitual daydreaming and youthful defiance were more than enough to persuade Freeman what to do. He proposed a lobotomy to Howard's father and stepmother. Howard's stepmother was adamant that a lobotomy was necessary, but after learning of his methods, Howard's father expressed doubts. When Howard's mother threatened divorce, his father relented, leaving his son in Walter Freeman's hands. 11-year-old Howard Dully was to become Freeman's youngest ever patient. On the 17th of December 1960, Howard woke with two swollen black eyes and a feverish brow. He recalls a severe headache, feeling confused and disorientated in a mental fog, totally oblivious to what Freeman had just done. Just a few hours earlier, Howard had been wheeled into an operating theatre and sedated with a series of unanaesthetized electroshocks to his brain. With Howard stunned unconscious, Freeman had performed his transorbital lobotomy through each of Howard's eye sockets. Howard survived his ordeal and was institutionalized into Agnew State Hospital for much of his adolescence, but he later obtained a college degree and remains alive and well, living in California. At the time of Howard's operation, the drug clopromazine had been approved in the US, offering a chemical alternative to Freeman's lobotomy. But it had not come soon enough for Howard, who very likely did not need any treatment whatsoever. The introduction of clopromazine severely dented Freeman's work, and the changing winds of media approval this time blew firmly in the face of Freeman's practice. His final transorbital lobotomy case was in 1967, a woman called Helen Mortensen. She died 3 days after Freeman cut through her brain. By this point, Freeman had performed nearly 4,000 lobotomies. Across the US, approximately 60,000 lobotomies had been performed between 1936 and 1956, largely thanks to Freeman's salesmanship. The medical community had finally caught up with Freeman, and after Helen Mortensen's death, he was banned from operating. By the late 1960s, there had been a growing body of research describing the limited benefits offered by the lobotomy, but far more significantly, the evidence showed that any limited benefit was considerably outweighed by the terrible risk of disabling complication to the patient, often resulting in death. Freeman retired from his work, but continued to lecture and follow up on his former patients. He died in 1972 from complications relating to an operation for cancer. Freeman was undoubtedly a talented doctor, motivated by a genuine desire to improve the lives of afflicted patients. But somewhere between his ego and his heartless approach to research, he derailed from his course toward pioneering greatness and destroyed thousands of lives with his unhinged ambition and reckless enthusiasm. Howard Dully, one of Freeman's survivors, said of him, "I don't think Freeman was evil. I think he was misguided. He tried to do what he thought was right, then he just couldn't give it up. That was the problem." The medical community rightly judged Freeman for his unscientific approach to selecting patients for surgery and his cavalier technique, which would soon be rightly recognized as barbaric. His blinkered obsession prevented him from recognizing the limitations of his methods and fueled his disregard for the prevailing opinions of the eminent psychiatric and neurosurgical communities. It was an era of science where doctors were perceived as infallible deities with divine skill and superhuman knowledge. With no access to the necessary information, there was no way of patients to legitimately challenge them. Nowadays, the flow of information is more abundant than ever, and doctors see their patients knowing full well that at everybody's fingertips lies an endless source of powerful information. Knowledge must be supported by that cornerstone of science, meticulous observation. Gone are the days when the medical community can practice on the basis of a hunch or a feeling. Doctors are now taught to collaborate with their patients, to act as a guide, but it is the patient who leads. No longer is treatment led by the whims of a doctor. At least that is the system to which we all aspire. A deference to science and a genuine consideration for medical ethics safeguards us against the horrors that Freeman and his orbitoclast inflicted on his patients. But despite our proud systems, there will always be a few who slip through the net. The basis of any doctor-patient relationship relies on the trust the patient places in their doctor. There will always be some who abuse that trust. Time and again, stories of appalling abuses will surface, where wayward health professionals exploit their patients for some misguided motivation. But the relentless productivity of this information age gives hope that Freeman's like will never be seen again. Thank you for listening to this fourth episode in Series 2 of Nightmares of a Doctor. Information regarding the sources used for this episode are available in the show notes. If you have any further thoughts or feedback for the show, please feel free to get in touch via our Instagram account at Nightmares of a Doctor or via email nightmaresofadoctor@gmail.com.